Every 4 years, the whole sports-loving planet is watching soccer's World Cup. Soccer is the world's most popular sport, so how did its governing body, FIFA, become the focus of the most massive corruption scandal in sports history? And why was that scandal broken by U.S. law enforcement? Our guest today is Ken Bensinger, veteran journalist who helped break the story with his investigation and reporting. His new book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Ken Bensinger to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Give us a sense of when you came into the story and when it started to pop up on your radar that something was amiss.
I got interested in this topic through one of the people who became central to the what became a massive criminal case, but long before anyone knew that he was a key component. This is an American soccer official named Chuck Blazer. I was interested because there was so little known about this person, and I had stumbled across him almost by accident and did a little bit of Googling on him and sort of discovered that this figure that was essentially anonymous in the U.S. was one of the 24 most powerful people in all world soccer, the most powerful American soccer official in history, and completely below the radar in terms of any kind of sports fandom coverage and anything. So I started digging into him and doing research, and what I discovered was he was very obviously tremendously corrupt. And the fact that he was so corrupt and had avoided notice was fascinating to me. And I'm an investigative reporter. I don't necessarily focus on sports, but I am interested in corruption and ways people take advantage of systems and that sort of thing. And he just seemed ripe for coverage. And so I wrote a big profile of him back in 2014. And that ran right before the last World Cup, which was in Brazil. And a year later, we learned about these massive arrests in Zurich, where many of your listeners will probably recall all these soccer officials were dragged out of their hotel rooms at 6 in the morning and put into jail. That was the moment that the secret U.S. criminal investigation was made public. And within a day or two, what was also revealed was that the chief cooperator in the investigation was none other than Chuck Blazer. And so suddenly I became the world expert on the guy who made the entire FIFA case work.
So what was it about him? How was he able to acquire as much power as he did, and as you indicate, somewhat anonymously?
I think Blazer is an interesting guy in that he's very smart, pretty well educated. He has a college degree in accounting, and was sort of the right guy at the right time. He got interested in soccer as an adult only because his children were playing youth soccer in Westchester County in the late 1970s. This was sort of a critical moment in the history of U.S. soccer because there was the first sort of boom of participation in the sport, driven in part by what was then a pro league that had superstars like Pelé playing in New York. He got in kind of on the ground floor of something that was happening and was, unlike sort of most of the people getting involved then, he had these huge ambitions and a lot of free time because the kind of jobs he did were sort of freelance jobs. He was a salesman, that sort of thing. And so while a lot of the other people who were involved in soccer at that point in the U.S. saw it as a weekend activity when they had their real jobs, this he immediately saw it as his future. And within a couple of years, had dedicated himself full-time to rising in the ranks, which he did very quickly.
One of the things that makes this story so incredible is the scale of the corruption. And it is safe to say, I believe, and using your evidence in this book, that we have never seen a case as big as this scandal of 2015.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the question, in the world of sports, I don't think there's any doubt about it. There have been other criminal cases involving corruption in sports, but they've always been sort of pretty focused. We might see, a cheating scandal at University of North Carolina for their football team, or we'll see a recruiting scandal at USC, or we'll see, some drug use issues in pro sports, that sort of thing. But when you talk about a scandal that involves so many different regions, countries, teams, executives over multiple continents. There's just nothing comparable in sports, and in fact, I would argue there's very, very little comparable in any field of business or otherwise. The Department of Justice, the amount of resources they put into this was tremendous. They had at times more than a dozen prosecutors working the case at once, which is a giant expenditure of resources from their point of view. To give you a point of comparison, the special counsel investigation of Robert Mueller has about 18 prosecutors. So maybe the most high-profile DOJ investigation ever is only, 50% larger than this case. And what they did in terms of outreach and the number of countries involved, is unprecedented in scope.
The other thing, too, is that they're digging by prosecutors, federal prosecutors, shows that corruption had gone on for a really long time, and we're going back to the 70s.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, the FIFA, which is the organization that runs world soccer, is 114 years old. It was started in 1904, but until about 1974, it was a pretty sleepy organization with not a lot of money and very little corruption. And everything changes in the 1970s, and there's a number of complicated reasons why that happens. But the principal thing that people need to know is that's when big commercial interests start getting involved in the game. In 1975, Coca-Cola signs its first sponsorship contract with FIFA, and other brands quickly follow suit. And then in the early 80s, with the advent of better international television transmission technology, you start seeing the first massive TV contracts for the World Cup and for other big soccer tournaments. And suddenly, this sleepy organization, which was basically living off ticket sales, so that's its primary source of income was just ticket sales at stadiums, is now seeing that revenue multiple times larger and most of it based on sponsorship and TV money. And when those interests came in, you start developing this whole class of middlemen, these sort of middlemen broker companies, they call themselves sports marketing companies, that buy the rights wholesale from the soccer organizations like FIFA and other organizations and then resell them. And that's the critical piece of the corruption. Those are the ones who are paying bribes to the soccer officials to get sweetheart deals to resell the rights.
So I'm just going to jump forward a little bit until we get into the meat of the story here, but on Sunday, July 15th, we're going to have the final, the World Cup final. How clean is the game now?
I liken this investigation to sort of the invasive surgery that they do on a very sick patient to remove the tumor, right? The person has cancer, you remove the tumor, and that's incredibly important, but it isn't the full treatment. What this criminal investigation did is highlighted some of the really worst abuses and removed some of the most corrupted officials from the sport. And it did a lot. I mean, more than 40 people were charged in the case, and about 24 or 25, I believe, have been convicted so far. And it removed a lot. But there's a culture of corruption that runs very deep throughout the many, many soccer organizations around the world. And I think it'd be unrealistic to expect it to be completely better now that you remove the worst apples. This thing needs time to heal. So what we've seen from FIFA is steps in the right direction. We've seen some reforms in terms of governance about the way that its different voting committees are formed and who's on them. We've seen women for the first time ever get places of power within FIFA, which is really important considering how popular the women's game is and how much money it makes for sport, and also just for general understanding of equity. And then we've seen the most important votes FIFA does open up and become more transparent. So I think those are steps in the right direction. But almost monthly, there's some other reminder of it that the corrupt culture still exists. We know just a couple days before the World Cup or a week before the World Cup started, the Soccer Federation of Ghana, the African country, was completely dissolved because a documentary was released showing all of it, basically all of its officials taking cash bribes on camera. And so I think it would be a little bit optimistic to think that everything is cleaned up. I think it's baby steps at this point.
We are talking with Ken Bensinger. The name of the new book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. What overlap, or is there overlap, between this and Russia's influence on our elections in 2016?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think as I reported this book, I was coming across all this stuff about Russia, but a lot of my reporting actually took place before the election, where Donald Trump, of course, was elected. And it, at the time, it seemed interesting, but not nearly as significant as it seems now. What I discovered was that this criminal case, which had such a massive reach, started small, but it started specifically as an investigation of Russia. The person who tipped off the FBI at the time to begin the investigation and to look into corruption within FIFA and Russia was none other than Christopher Steele, who, of course, we all know now is the person who wrote the Trump-Russia dossier. That's such an interesting and controversial document. It's important that Steele actually started by tipping off the U.S. to FIFA, because that not only set off this investigation, but also led to a relationship of trust between him and the FBI, so that when he did create this Trump dossier, they would take it seriously and receive it. One has to imagine that the FBI gets all kinds of crazy tips all the time. If they didn't know Christopher Steele the way they did and trust him, they wouldn't have taken that document seriously. So in that sense, the FIFA investigation was an important first step towards what is now the Trump-Russia investigation. But there's, you know, there's other things as well. I mean, Russia, the reason that Steele got his antenna up about Russia and FIFA back in 2010 is because at the time FIFA was bidding to host the World Cup, which it, of course, won the bid. And what Steele had found was that Russia seemed to be up to no good in its approach, that Russia was doing anything it could, including bending or breaking all the rules to win the bid. And Steele had been working for England, which was also bidding for it, and on paper should have won it handily. But it became clear that Russia was going to beat England because they were essentially cheating and going to steal the vote. That's an important timing thing, because this was in 2010, when this was the time of the so-called Russia reset. And it's a bit hard to remember now, but Russia at the time was on good terms with the U.S., and we were having this special moment with them where we were agreeing on stuff, and everything was copacetic. And in fact, what we see now, looking back, was this was one of the first signs of the kind of Russia we're now accustomed to seeing, which was a Machiavellian, results-oriented nation-state that does things from a very top-down perspective and is willing to really push things to get what it wants. So, and the cast of characters is very similar as well. Robert Mueller, who's now investigating Trump, of course, in Russia, was the head of the FBI at the time, and it was his directive that pushed this one particular FBI group to look for what they call transnational money laundering cases involving Russia. And so really, Mueller was sort of turned the FBI onto this kind of case. James Comey was the director of the FBI when that FIFA case went public and was at the press conference announcing those arrests in Zurich we discussed. The parallels just go on and on. And then, of course, there's the very interesting fact that Chuck Blazer, who we discussed before, and several other people wrapped up in this case all lived in the Trump Tower, and several of them were friends with Donald Trump.
That's remarkable. I don't want it to be lost, and it shouldn't be because it's the subtitle of the book, which is How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. But let's focus on that just for a second as a direct question. For a sport that is, say, fourth or fifth most popular in this country, is not at the top, how did the U.S. become so involved in the criminal investigation and ultimately in an investigation that shows that there was corruption at nearly every level at every aspect of the game?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny. It is an odd thing. You think, what are we doing mucking around in this sport we can barely pay attention to when we're too busy wrapped up in other sports? But I think in a funny way that apparent irony is a critical piece of this. The history of FIFA corruption is that it's not exactly a secret. In fact, it was sort of the best known secret in the world. Everyone who followed the sport knew that FIFA had a corruption problem. There had been pretty great journalism over the years about out of England, particularly, of FIFA's problems, and yet no one from law enforcement ever did anything about it. Brazil, which had a horrible problem, their prosecutors would routinely turn down referrals for it to investigate. The English law enforcement wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole because they were so scared that FIFA would punish them and prevent them from winning a World Cup hosting and that sort of thing, you know, which is a joke on them because they never got it anyway. The Swiss would periodically open investigations and then close them without ever prosecuting anyone. And it became clear that no one in the world was willing to do it because the power of soccer in other countries is so tremendous. And it's hard to imagine here where it's the fifth sport, but in Europe and South America, it's the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth most important sports. It is the only thing, and it has very powerful political influence. And those countries ultimately were afraid to do anything. Conversely, here in the U.S., because soccer is small, I think an FBI, DOJ, and ultimately IRS squad could investigate this with very little, if any, political pressure, because there's no lobby, there's no maddeningly powerful soccer lobby in Capitol Hill to outshout everyone else and prevent an investigation from happening, or to tell, or to get the Senate to investigate, you know, with a committee hearing why this is happening. It was unimpeded, and so oddly, the unpopularity of soccer aided the DOJ in this case.
So I just want to go back to Chuck Blazer for a moment, because fascinating. This is the person you profiled and watched. And I don't want to give a lot away, but he has passed away since. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in how we should view him ultimately. He was a cooperator, but he still was never sentenced for an amazing amount of crime that was committed during his time.
Yeah, someone will have to fact check me on this, but my recollection is he may have pleaded guilty to more criminal counts than anyone else in the case. I think he pleaded guilty to 10 different criminal counts. Just a deeply, deeply corrupt person. And, you know, he's been called sometimes a whistleblower, and I strongly disagree with that that qualification, because my sense of a whistleblower is someone who comes forward voluntarily to denounce but wrongdoing. In his case, he only cooperated because he was caught in a corner by the FBI and the IRS, right, and had no, and they gave him a choice, either go to prison or cooperate. So I don't see that as a whistleblower stance. And, you know, but I also don't want to diminish from the good things he did from the sport. This is a guy who basically created the women's national team in the U.S. in the mid-80s. He's someone who helped create the Women's World Cup, and he got Major League Soccer its first revenue-positive TV contract. Those are all things that he did. He had a lot of other things that benefited the sport. He grew it tremendously in this country and in this region, which would be North and Central America and the Caribbean. He played a big role in that. He was so corrupt and did so many bad things. I don't know if it really vindicates him that he brought everyone down and was ultimately, you know, a stool pigeon for the DOJ investigation. You know, if you talk to prosecutors and you talk about whether they feel that someone's passing away before being sentenced allows them to escape their crimes, I think they usually don't take that perspective. I think they usually feel that, you know, death is sort of the ultimate punishment, and the case of someone like this who's very ill and had lots of health problems, I don't think that they particularly felt aggrieved that they never got to put him behind bars.
So as we look to the U.S., Canada, and Mexico coming together to host the World Cup in 2026, is it, and we look at this the same way, or at least I guess I do, the same way that you look at an Olympic win, which is, oh, well, what did we give away and what happened to get that here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you know, the U.S. had tried to get the World Cup for 2022 by itself and had very notoriously lost that bid to Qatar, which is a very controversial decision by FIFA. And one of that and the Russia decision were undoubtedly the two things that brought FIFA the most headaches ever. I think this time around, the U.S. decided to link up with Canada and Mexico more than anything to make it more appealing to FIFA's voters to vote, you know, those of them who had resentments against the U.S. for the criminal case, to link up with Canada and Mexico who weren't involved in that criminal case, to sort of as a buffer to shield them from negative feelings. I think it's, you know, the economics of hosting massive events like the World Cup and the Olympics are not, you know, don't tend to say that it's a good idea financially. A lot of countries lose their shirts over it. Countries like Brazil, you know, hosted the Olympics and the World Cup, and now is in a horrible financial disaster, not to mention huge corruption scandals. So the track record isn't strong. That said, the 1994 World Cup was held in the U.S. and is widely regarded as the most financially successful World Cup in history, turned a huge profit. And I think what Canada and the U.S. and to a lesser extent Mexico bring is really excellent infrastructure that's already in place, that we already have the stadiums, we already have the hotels and the airports and the highways and transport. And so the thought is that the cost, the public bill is going to be small because they don't have to build stadiums, whereas countries like Russia essentially have to build most of the stadiums from scratch, and the taxpayer shoulders a giant burden. We don't have to do that, and we can really talk about this maybe being an economic event, whereas a Russia or a Qatar, it really has much more to do with political influence and prestige and PR than economics.
The book is fascinating. It really is a terrific read. Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Ken Bensinger, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, it was a delight. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Red Card, published by Simon & Schuster. Ken Bensinger is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.